It is such a very great pleasure for me to share today's book club segment with you, because joining us is an author whose works of historical fiction many of us have read and loved for years already. I know that we have a huge number of Philippa Gregory fans in the audience. I know because her name comes up every time we have a conversation about your favorite books. She is a writer who has a knack for helping us to revisit the past and experience what it might have been like to live through the times and the intrigue of situations like the gunpowder plot, the chaos of the tulip fever, the conniving and shuffling for power within the Tudor court. Notably, I think for many of us, she allows us to view these moments in history often through the eyes of the women who observed them, who survived them in some cases, who influenced them, who were often not recorded in that history. Philippa was appointed a commander of the Order of the British Empire in this year's New Year's Honours list, not only for her services to literature, but also for her work for charity, which I hope we'll have a moment to talk about a little bit later in the interview. But the chief reason for talking to her today is that her latest novel, Dark Tides, has just come out in paperback in South Africa. It was released late last year, and you can now find it in paperback in any good bookstore in South Africa. It's such a delight to have her with us today to talk about this book and about her writing career in general. And just a reminder that if you have questions for her, please send them through now. Philippa Gregory, welcome to Cape Talk. It's wonderful to have you on the show today.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you. I have to say, I kind of long to be with you in South Africa, but those days will come again.
I take it that means you've been here before, Philippa. How many times and have you been to Cape Town?
I've been with you twice, and I came out, I spoke at the first Cape Town Literary Festival ever, and it was fabulous. I really remember it well because my publishers had a stand for me, and I was going to give a talk on the stand, and we had to take the walls down because so many people came. It was completely thrilling. It really was. It was a great day.
I'm not surprised to hear that you were mobbed, but yes, absolutely. We hope that those days will be back with us again soon and that we can have that opportunity in person next time. For now, though, thank you for making time for the phone conversation. Before we talk about Dark Tides, let's talk a little bit about your writing career in general. Philippa, I know that you are renowned as the queen of British historical fiction, but some of our listeners might be surprised to learn that you were actually born in Kenya, weren't you?
Yes, my parents were there when it was a colony, and were there. My father was on East African Airways. Okay. So he was flying round Africa then, and tragically there was a plane crash, and my mother came home in 56. And so I have no recollection of it whatsoever, but I am proud of being Africa-born.
Now, you grew up in Bristol, Philippa. Did you always know from an early age that you wanted to write and to make that your profession?
No, I started off, I'm very, very, very keen on animals, and now that's widened to an interest in conservation and the natural world. And so I started off hoping that I would do something with animals, and then it became apparent to me that I had very, very little grasp of science, and that was not going to change. But what I always, you know, my great love was always reading and writing. Mm-hmm. And so when I left school, I went to journalism college and became a print journalist and then a radio journalist. And then I decided that really what I should have done long before was go to university. So I went to university relatively late. Mm-hmm. And then fell in love with history. So that happened in my early 20s, and from then I went to Sussex University to do a BA, and then Edinburgh University, and did my PhD at Edinburgh. And it was after that that I realised that I would spend the rest of my life writing about history.
It was after that you realised it, but it was while you were doing your PhD that you actually started work on the first novel, Wideacre, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, juggling a doctorate in literature while trying to get your own career started must have been extraordinary. That was back in 1985, though. Philippa, and could you ever have imagined what lay in store for you?
And no, because it wasn't even a career choice. I was literally writing Wideacre. Mm-hmm. For fun. I was working on the PhD during the day. I should add in there for people who don't believe that women work hard, that I was raising a baby at the same time. But, you know, like the funny thing is that when you've got a lot to do, you just, you know, work work harder. My daughter said to me one time, the only option is to sleep faster. So, I was working on 18th century novels, and I was absolutely absorbed with the evolution of the form of the novel. And it therefore was just so natural to write a novel about the 18th century mm-hmm. with the awareness of how novels developed. I mean, I didn't mean to serve an apprenticeship in novel writing, but in fact I did. I read 200 18th century novels in the 3 years of my PhD. And, you know, at the end of that, you couldn't really help but know how a novel was put together. Mm. I didn't plan it, but I just naturally understood structure and timing and narrative voice just from having immersed myself in novels at the very time that they were being, as it were, invented.
I don't know if you give yourself enough credit. I mean, there are many of us who did literature degrees who didn't walk out of it with the ability to then go out and do it ourselves, Philippa. But I mean, you've written so broadly across different eras. One can understand the fascination with the 18th century based on your actual studies. But since then, of course, your books have taken you beyond and before that period. What sort of sets you off in a new direction when you sit down to start a new novel? Does it generally start with the spark of an historical character or a story you come across in your research that just makes something go ping in your mind? Or do you actually deliberately choose the time span that you want to write within and sort of set off from there?
No, you're right. It's a ping. And usually the story, you know, the story always contains a character. So it's the fact that I suddenly understand something about a character in history, usually a woman, because they're the ones I'm looking out for, instinctively because I'm a woman, but also because they're the stories that aren't the familiar ones. Mm. So I come across something and I go like, wow, you know, usually I go, wow, I didn't know that. If I don't know it, it's likely that lots of other people don't know it either. And then I embark on a long period of research, usually about a year's research. And then during that time, I realize that I have an adequate understanding to start writing. And then I just go on reading and researching, and I go on writing, and the two progress together, usually over a span of about 2 years, sometimes more.
Now, Philippa, you were already a well-established writer before The Other Boleyn Girl came out, but that really was an absolute game changer that set you off on a trajectory to the fame you enjoy today within this genre. It led to a BBC television series and, of course, to the big screen film adaptation, which so many of our listeners will have seen. What was it about that particular storyline that you think has captivated readers all over the world? So, you know, is it perhaps the fact that these are the women of Henry VIII's world that in most of our history studies are reduced to the list that says divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived? And that's they're kind of the footnote to the story of history. And yet you've brought them to life so richly in these books. Do you think that was it? Or what else do you attribute the success of that particular novel to?
I'm sure it's that. And that explains, I think, the success of a lot of the Tudor novels that followed The Other Boleyn Girl. But with The Other Boleyn Girl, that's a classic example of me coming across a name, Mary Boleyn, which was a ship, one of Henry VIII's ship was restored and named Mary Boleyn. And I came across that in the London Library and went like, that can't be right. I've never heard of Mary Boleyn, and I looked her up because I was in a library, couldn't have been easier. And there she was, the sister of Anne Boleyn, the lover of Henry VIII before he met Anne Boleyn. And I just had one of these moments where you go like, that's extraordinarily interesting. And as far as I know, pretty well unknown. Mm. At the time of writing, there was no biography of her. She was literally hidden from history. That's in amazing. The great phrase of Sheila Rowbottom. And so I had to just ferret around, you know, to find she was mentioned in things. We know the colour of the dress she wore at a party because it's in the wardrobe records. And we know that Henry had two babies with her, one of them a son, mm-hmm. one of them called Henry. And then you start going like, this just is so fascinating. What if he had married her rather than Anne? Mm. You know, history would be completely different. Mm. But, you know, just, I mean, so it was such a provocative name to find and such a provocative story. And I think anybody who reads the book has that same sense of excitement and discovery. And the other thing which I would say I invented with that novel, which I hadn't done before, is I wrote it in first person present tense. So there was absolutely no attempt at historical distance or being or hindsight. I deliberately eliminated that from the novel. So literally, you go, here is someone I've never heard of, but I believe she's true. And here is the story of her life, and I don't know what's going to happen. And one of the greatest compliments that was paid to me after it was published was my agent at the time said to me, I couldn't stop reading it. I had to know what would happen. And I went, this is the execution of Anne Boleyn. You know what happens. But of course, if you were there at the time, you didn't know.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what was going to happen. In fact, everybody thought she would get a last minute pardon. So it's so rich to write history as if it's happening in the here and now. And it's so exciting for readers, and it's such a different way of approaching history.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think if I have, people sometimes say I reinvented the genre. I think if there's one single thing that I've done which has made a remarkable difference to the genre, it would be that. It would be saying, let's not think of it as history, let's think of it as present.
That brings us to the point, I mean, you are a writer of historical fiction, usually inspired by factual characters or factual events, but obviously there is going to be a great deal of creative license taken in developing the character, particularly the characters of women who, as you've rightly said, were largely absent from the records of these years. You've obviously said to us you're meticulous in your research and you devote a huge amount of time to the research before starting a new novel even. Talk to us about that balance between the line between what is real and what is research and where you allow yourself to just imagine.
Well, all history, all written history, every history book you pick up is, in a sense, a construction. It's what the historian thinks happened. He or she will have looked at the evidence before them and said, I prefer this piece of evidence over this piece of evidence. You know, when there's a controversy, there's a weighing up process and a historian comes down one side or another. What we do is show our workings. So you say to the reader, nobody knows what happened here, but these are the current theories. And this often you say, and this is where I come down. Writing fiction is that's one of the key instances where it's completely different from writing history. You don't have the luxury of being able to, in a sense, discuss with the reader how you've taken the decision. Because if you're writing a fiction, it's got to be entirely convincing. The reader has got to be taken up by you into this world. And ideally, they don't come out till they finish the book. So, you know, it's a capture of the reader. It's not a discussion of the material with the reader. So when there's, you know, so when it's on the record and we're pretty clear what went on, for instance, a royal progress, we know the destinations, we know the dates, we sometimes even know what parties they had along the way and the food, then that's what you find in my novel, unless I've made a mistake, which can happen, of course. But ideally, what you'll find in my novel is exactly what you would find in the record. There is where we know what happened. There is what happened. Where it differs is if there's something and we don't know what happened, and sometimes those are the most important things at all. For instance, the disappearance of the princes in the Tower during the reign of Richard III. Nobody knows. But I can't write a novel in which you come across a footnote and goes, nobody knows. Sorry, there should be a chapter here, but I'm just going to leave a blank so that when we find out, I can write it. No, of course not. That's not how you write fiction. So I have to take a decision, and I take a decision always based on what I think is most likely on the basis of the research I've done. But it's always a fiction. I never deny that it's a fiction, because obviously it is. Nobody knows. So what you get is my best guess, written in the most convincing way that I can do, because and I've got my other hat on, then I'm a novelist. Of course I'm going to make a good story out of it, but the decision of the choice of the option is always based on the history. It's not based on the best story.
I'm in conversation, just for those who might have joined us late to the show, with best-selling international author Philippa Gregory. And her most recent novel called Dark Tides has just been released in paperback in South Africa. You might have already picked it up in hardback late last year. Philippa, I think the ardent fans will know that Dark Tides is the second in the Fairmile series, which began with the book Tidelands. And I just want to say that if you haven't read Tidelands, you can start with Dark Tides. I actually came to them that way, but you can, I think you will be enriched in your reading of the second book if you have read the first one as context, but they can be taken up separately. Philippa, this is a story of people caught between different worlds, really. There are sort of two parallel storylines. There is the story of Eleanor and her family of mainly women running a warehouse in the Docklands of London, and then her brother Ned, who is across the ocean in the new colonies of New England in the Northern American area. Also a man caught between different worlds, who is far too close to the native Indian population for his townspeople's liking, who is wanted as a single man in need of a wife, to quote Jane Austen, but also uncomfortable in that role. Let's start with Eleanor and the storyline in London, which then takes us also to the canals of Venice. These are, if I understand it correctly, entirely fictional characters. This is not a story of a name that you have clutched from a history book and developed. But what made you want to write about this particular period and in this particular setting?
This is the second book of what is going to be, I hope, a long saga of this family. What I wanted to do was to talk about a family rising from poverty, where, of course, most of our families started, because that's the majority of people in England. So they start very, very poor in West Sussex. And book two sees them. They've got to London. They've got a little warehouse. They've got a horse and cart. They're running a quayside business of very, very small imports and coastal trade. And there were a number of women entrepreneurs, particularly widows, working in London at this time. Again, a history that we don't know much about. So I'm really looking at that history of women to give me the story of these two women, which is literally pinching and scraping and saving and trying to make a business in what is very much a man's world, in what is for anybody poor, a very, very difficult world. It's the time of the restoration of Charles II. So you have this explosion of luxury and wealth just up the river. Yeah. And really their challenge is, how do you tap into the new science, the new rationalism, the new travel, the burgeoning empire, the overseas trade, you know, and at the moment they're literally clinging on almost by their fingertips in this very poor dock. There isn't a family that I'm basing this on directly, except it gives me so much pleasure that my family are on the dockside, literally in the warehouse where their warehouse is in this period. And so I have that from my family history. I have a wonderful cousin who does a lot of family research. And I went like, well, you know, my family rose up from that very, very humble beginning. And, you know, that gives me a real added interest and a real sense of affinity with these women. But of course, once I start writing a fiction and I'm not for once locked on the facts, I'm very much freer to really follow my interest in it, which is one of the things that takes us to Venice, because Venice is glorious in this period. And I have a son of the household who becomes a doctor and goes to Italy, as so many young men who were interested in science and medicine, because Italy is the absolute center of learning at that stage because of the Renaissance. And he falls foul in Venice of the authorities and an incredible scheming woman who is completely fictional, but I just adored her. She's a real anti-heroine.
She was such a treat to read.
A wonderful character. She's gorgeous, isn't she? She's as bad as we would all like to be if we could ever sort of rid ourselves of being brought up nicely.
Well, I'm delighted you've answered my question as to where to from here, that there is intended to be at least another book, if not several books, to come in this story. I hope one of those will follow the story of Ned, the brother of the family, Philippa. We're almost out of time. Very briefly, as I said, he is a man caught between two very different worlds, trying to find a place in the world where he can live with himself and with the kind of integrity he wants to live, and finding that very difficult.
He's an ex-Cromwell soldier, so he's absolutely committed to equality of men, alas, not women, but he's absolutely committed to the equality of men. And he thinks that when he goes to the new world, to New England, he will find a new world in which that becomes possible. And what he discovers, as so many other colonialists, as you know, some of your own listeners, will, their families will have discovered, that is that you very often take the problems with you. You don't, you, it's very, very hard to leave behind your prejudices and your difficulties and the obstacles to your thinking fresh when you go to a fresh place. And what he finds in New England is not a real class obstacle to his success, but that he finds a society which is very much what he hoped, but it's part of the Native American people and he can't join them.
We have to leave it there, and I hope that's enough to entice our listeners to pick up a copy of Dark Tides in a bookstore near them if they haven't already read it. Philippa, it's been such a treat having you on the show today. Thank you very much for making time for us, and I hope it is a conversation we can continue in person one day when you're able to visit Cape Town again.
I really look forward to it, and thank you so much.
Philippa Gregory, the international best-selling number one author of so many wonderful books of historical fiction. Most recently, though, Dark Tides, which is published by Simon & Schuster, available in South Africa via Jonathan Ball Publishers, and you'll find it in store at around about 330 Rand a copy.